This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Thank you for downloading this programme from the BBC. This programme is part of World War One on the BBC. For more information, go to bbc.co.uk/ww1.
I'm Dan Snow. Welcome to Voices of the First World War. In the years leading up to the centenary of the war, the last of those who actually experienced it have passed away. But the Imperial War Museums and the BBC had recorded interviews with many veterans to try to capture what it was like to actually be there. This series listens to those stories.
We marched to Ypres, but whether it was from... Oh, no, I had a bus journey. They took us by bus from Saint-Omer to Zonnebeck.
And they were London buses?
They were London buses. Open tops.
Had they been painted, or were they...
No, they hadn't been camouflaged in any way, no. Because I well remember, I thought, oh, I'll go to the top. And, you know, I had the opportunity of going upstairs, and I went right to the top and thought how lovely it would be to see France from the top. And I went right to the front, and another chap came with me, and I thought, oh, lucky we are. Until it was several hours' journey, and it began to rain, and it poured in torrents, and I got absolutely wet through.
In September 1914, Ypres was an obscure but prosperous medieval Belgian town, which had thrived for centuries off the wool trade. Yet within months, it and its surrounding area had been terribly damaged. Ypres was at the epicentre of some of the most vicious fighting on the Western Front, and would remain so for 4 years to come.
As I remember marching right through Ypres from the bus.
Private Laurie Field.
And as we marched through, the cloth hall was intact, hadn't been touched. Now, the cloth hall was the beauty spot of Ypres.
In August and September, the Germans had lunged at Paris in pursuit of a quick victory. That failed. Both sides raced north, trying to get clear of the other. The British reached the coast around Ypres first. The Germans desperately tried to drive them back and secure other channel ports like Dunkirk, Calais and Boulogne. The British outside Ypres took up positions astride the road to Menin, which ran east out of the city.
We were standing by in this wood on the side of the road.
Trooper George Jameson of the Northumberland Hussars.
We didn't know what we were going to do or what we were going to have to do, simply waiting there. That was an awful lot of war, waiting. And while we were in there, of course, the Germans were shelling all around the place and there was a lot of shrapnel flying around. And we were sort of dodging and hiding behind trees and trying to take cover, and we were wondering what was going to happen next.
They knew far more in England what was happening than we did.
So you had no idea that the Battle of Ypres was about to break up?
No, or anything like that.
He said, you're going to take part, he said, in the most important battle, he said, of the war.
Private William Holbrook of the Royal Fusiliers. Holbrook remembers Sir John French, the commander of the British Expeditionary Force, visiting his unit to boost their morale.
He said, and in a few days, he said, you'll be following up a beaten enemy. That was his words. Well, I've thought about it since then. Beaten enemy.
They were shelling us like nobody's business. Gelleveld was decimated, and then Hooge was getting it. Hooge had been taken over by the divisional people as a headquarters.
We made the attack from Zonnebeek towards Passchendaele, advanced to 1,000 yards under shell fire with my own particular platoon, and only had two men hit.
Sergeant Thomas Painting of the King's Royal Rifle Corps.
And having done that, I'd got to go across 200 yards of open ground. Well, we formed up there, we advanced over this open ground, and Jerry opened fire on us with a machine gun and everything he could turn out. And in my own particular platoon, which was 50 men, only 17 of us got across. The others were dead, were all killed in that 200 yards, killed and wounded.
One of these fellows asked me for a light, and I struck a match and held it out to him, and as I held that out to him, he just dropped. And that was about the first thing I can recollect of anybody suddenly passing out of existence. Really the first experience of being scared stiff, wondering when I'd cop it next, and seeing other people being hit, being close to the sharp end of the job, so to speak. One very quickly developed the sort of feeling, well, this is war. It can happen to anybody. Thank God it hasn't been me. And that was about all.
We were at a place called Langemark, and we did a bayonet charge. And I remember being with a chap by me, ready to move off, when this chap got a shell on his knee.
Lance Corporal Joe Armstrong, of the Loyal North Lancashire Regiment.
And it was hanging on by a few bits of skin. Well, quite frankly, I wasn't in that bayonet charge. He emptied his water bottle. I used his bandage. He emptied my water bottle. I used my bandage. I'm only sorry now that I didn't know about the tourniquet. I got him on my shoulder, and in my tinpot way, I was walking to our trenches, when suddenly I heard somebody shout, and it must have been a German, "Go back, you bloody fool, go back." I was walking toward the German trenches. So I walked back. So I took him then and put him behind underneath a tree. And what could I do? And you know what he did? He was a Cockney. He said, "God blimey, mate, you ain't half a toff." He just got hold of his blinking leg and he threw the rest of his leg over the blinking tree.
So he snapped the remaining skin?
And over the tree. His leg, you know, over the tree. I had to leave him. It no doubt he'd die. Without, of course, there was some stretcher bearers who would do the job properly with a tourniquet. I don't know. Of course, it might have congealed enough to save his life. I wouldn't know.
When the bugle went, we all go into the Germans, of course, charge the Germans.
Lance Corporal William Finch of the Worcestershire Regiment. On the 31st of October, the Germans were on the verge of breaking through into Ypres. Finch took part in a counterattack on the Gelevelt Chateau. After the charge, he encountered the German Uhlan cavalry on the Menin Road.
And when I seen them, they stopped and I stopped, I suppose. Must have done. Brought sense into me after the charge, which I could never explain what I'd done in it. As I went to make a move, then the jerry opened fired straight across the Mellon Road at me with a machine gun. And that's when I got the leg. As I dropped down, I called out for help. And as I got up, jerry hit me in the back. And the metal disc on my back as my ration tin saved me from having my back bone broken.
What we started doing the night. It's a passing guard attack. Thousands of them. You couldn't see them in the half dark. You know, there's all trees and bushes.
The fellow got to me after a time, laying there by myself. It was night time. They got me on a German horse sheet, which was laid by the side of me. And put me on the sheet he did and dragged me across the other side of the Mellon Road.
He came along and said, "The colonel's been killed." "He's been killed?" I said, "Him." I said, "No. God, he fought the life out of me." I said, I looked at one who was a father, one of yours, you know.
Did it upset you greatly? I mean, you know, because this was a real friend of yours, aren't we?
Yes. I didn't know what to do myself for days. When he got killed, somebody said, "Obliterate the whole battalion." Absolutely dumbstruck. They couldn't understand it. They thought so much of him.
And the rain and one thing and another, I got this German arse and kept myself covered. And all of a sudden, in the daylight in the morning, the sheet was thrown off me, and it was a German officer stood by me with his revolver at my head. And he searched me, And I said, well, I can't do any harm now. And as he was going through me, pulled out a wallet, Canadian wallet that I got on me, took his pictures. And then he threatened me again as he walked away to lie down. I'd got to lie down.
We all spoke about 700 or 800 strong when we went there. Then we had this draft of 200 that made us 900 so strong. We had 32 officers. That was on the night of the 11th of November. By 8 o'clock next morning, we had no officers left and 34 men.
The night. Including all the new raw recruits that come up?
Yes, yes. I never saw them all then. Never saw the Australian. I don't know what happened to them. There were only 34 of us. As all was left of the Fusiliers.
Troops fought for days in shell holes as the front line ebbed and fragmented around them. German soldiers swarmed forward as their artillery pounded the British with shrapnel and high explosives. William Finch lay in a ditch as all this went on around him.
I lay for 3.5 days without being found, keeping myself soaked with water, the rain. I got a handkerchief in my pocket and I put it into the sheet above me, into the puddle of the water, and kept squeezing it in my mouth and spitting it out. And I'm still laying in a ditch with the water still running under me. And I was still watching the Germans running about attacking, and I couldn't see who they was attacking, but they was making moves and shooting. And I dared and turned to my left, to look to my left to see who it was.
I saw a German's head coming through the bushes, you know, the little round caps they wore. Groaned and I thought, oh, perhaps he's wounded, I thought. I crawled out and pulled the bush away. I'll never forget that fellow, just looking at his face. He looked pitiful up at me and he said, Wasser, Wasser. So I said, I need enough of that German for that water. So I got my water bottle out and opened his lips and poured some down his throat, you know. And as I poured it down his throat, blood and water was coming out of the hole in his side. God, I thought he was in the state that was groaning, he was. No, then he kept saying to me, Kleiner Kinder. And I didn't know then, I do now, these little children. And he's going like this, trying to make the sizes of, you know, three he got. He's saying, Kleiner Kinder. I thought, oh, God. And I get out every now and again, I kept thinking about it and opening his lips and giving some water. His eyes were looking up at me. And about 2 o'clock, he just died.
And as I lay there the 3.5 day, I said, I hope, please God, I was found that day, which I was. There was 2 bayonets towards my head. And I shouted up, quick, have mercy on me, I'm English. And they said, what brings you here? There was 2 Coldstream Guardsmen. They went away and brought back a stretcher and put me onto it and carried me into their lines. And they fed me with chocolate. That's the first I'd had from the time I was knocked over.
Ypres ended in stalemate. Ypres would be fought over for years to come.
And then eventually I got down to France and the ambulance, horse ambulance was there, met me, Salvation Army. And they said, well, all your regiment, the horses all been knocked over. Only a few left. When they got to me to hospital, I was stripped and cleaned up. And then operated on, and next morning the surgeon come to me and the saucer full of bullets, and he asked me if I wanted any souvenirs, and I said I didn't. He said, well, you'll have 6 in your leg for the remainder of your life, so. And he said, we got 47 bullets we took out of your ear, machine gun bullets.
World War I on the BBC, on TV, radio, and online.